Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the crisis in Ukraine following a warning by its first post-independence president, Leonid Kravchuk, to Parliament that the country was on the verge of civil war. Jeffrey Mankoff, the Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies' Russian and European programs, joins us to discuss the struggle within the country between the pro-European majority and the pro-Russia minority, and the wider impasse between Europe and Russia, between democratic values and power politics. Then we will examine the assault on press freedom by Egypt's military government, with 20 journalists from Al Jazeera facing charges of belonging to terrorist groups, harming national unity and social peace, and spreading false news. An expert on the Arab media, Marwan Krady, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss the military's intimidation of the Egyptian press and the role of the chief backers of the military regime, Saudi Arabia, in influencing Arab media and spreading the Saudi royal family's model of feudal politics and reactionary religion. Then finally, we will speak with John Cronin, the Senior Fellow in Environmental Affairs at the Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies and the founder and CEO of the Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries. The author with Robert Kennedy Jr. of The River Keepers, he worked for decades with Pete Seeger on cleaning up the Hudson River. He joins us to discuss the life and legacy of Beacon, New York's most famous resident, Pete Seeger, who eschewed celebrity and lived by the motto, think globally but act locally. And joining us now is Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasian Program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Mankoff.
Thank you.
And the former president, or in fact the first post-independence president of Ukraine, Kravchuk, spoke to the parliament and warned in very dire terms that the country was on the brink of civil war. Is that your understanding?
You know, the situation's certainly gotten worse. I think the potential for, you know, widespread unrest is there. Calling it civil war at this point may be a little bit premature, but I do think that given the dynamics of how the confrontations between the authorities and the protesters have developed over the last couple of weeks, we're definitely, I think, at a tipping point where the possibility of much more serious unrest cannot be excluded.
Well, the first post-Soviet president, you know, Kravchuk, speaking to Parliament, of course, he was speaking to Kuchma was also there, and the other, Yushchenko, who was ousted by the current guy, and who, of course, was poisoned as well. We all recall that. They were all in attendance, and this has followed, of course, the fact that the former prime minister, Azarov, who apparently was widely despised in the country, stepped down. He's known as the family banker because of the Yanukovych's family's flagrant kleptocratic behavior. And he's been replaced by a kind of loyal a flunky, if you will, of Yanukovych's. So they're shuffling the deck, but are they dealing with the crisis itself?
Not so much. It is kind of shuffling the deck chairs on the sinking ship. You know, the protests began back in November in response to Yanukovych's decision to do an about-face on this planned association agreement that he had been intending to sign with the European Union. And that was bad enough, but I think that we've really seen the protest movement grow and spread across the country over the course of the last month or so, in part because the government has failed to address some of the more deep-seated problems that the country faces, and it actually sought to deal with the protests against the EU agreement by using force. And so now, you know, what we have is not people protesting just against decision to turn the country's back on the EU, but on the government's use of force, on its unwillingness to accept alternative points of view, its basic unresponsiveness to the wishes of the society. So if anything, I think what the government has done is it's united a lot of the country against it. You know, Ukraine is a fairly divided country. And, you know, if this was going to be an argument about Russia versus the EU, those divisions, I think, would be very salient. But, you know, right now, I think they've been shunted aside to some degree because you have so much popular fury, popular anger being directed at the government.
And is this largely due to the fact that this ruling family, with the eldest son, a former dentist, basically shaking down the oligarchs, saying, you know, I'm your new partner, and the fact that they've stashed billions away? And, I mean, it's sort of tacky, from my understanding, rather like what happened in Tunisia. You know, the Arab Spring began because the Tunisian people were fed up with the excesses of the first family. Is that what's going on here?
I think that's part of it, but that's not the entire story. You know, in Tunisia, this was you know, years and decades sort of building up, whereas, you know, in Ukraine, they've only had Yanukovych since 2010. But, you know, I think you can definitely see the country kind of moving in that direction. Ukraine, unlike its immediate neighbors, you know, Russia and Belarus, actually has a pretty robust, I don't want to necessarily say democratic, but let's say pluralist politics. And that means that, you know, there's more, the media is a little bit feistier, you know, there are real opposition parties, there are votes that actually lead to transfers of power, which means that it's difficult for this kind of thing, which is not all that unusual, unfortunately, in the post-Soviet world. It's harder to do in a country like Ukraine because there are countervailing forces. There are people who are going to notice what's going on and be able to take political advantage of it. And, you know, to call it tacky, I think, is right, but it also, I think, understates the seriousness of it. And, you know, Yanukovych, I think, was looking around at his neighbors and was thinking, you know, maybe we can build a political system here that looks like what they have in Russia, for example. But unfortunately for him, Ukraine's not Russia.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a deputy director and fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies' Russia and Eurasia program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. So it's clearly having an effect on the broader EU-Russia relations because the EU-Russia summit that was supposed to last for 2 days in Brussels in the last couple of days ended in just 3 hours. Putin got a pretty chilly reception. He's trying to put on a big show for himself and for Russia at Sochi with the Winter Olympics, and I don't imagine what's happening in the Ukraine is good news for him since he seems to have staked so much on the political survival of Yanukovych.
Mm-hmm. Right. He has a whole host of challenges connected with the Olympics in Sochi, and this, you know, only adds to the bill, I suppose. You know, there's no love lost between Putin and Yanukovych or between Russia and Yanukovych. You know, this was a guy who spent the last couple of years since his inauguration as president touting Ukraine's European ambitions. And it took a lot of arm twisting, carrots as well as sticks on the part of the Kremlin to get him to change his mind. But I don't think there's any illusion in Moscow that if Yanukovych had his choice, this isn't what he would be doing. The problem from their perspective is they don't really have a good alternative. You know, the previous president, Yushchenko, was a very committed pro-European. He had a lot of other faults that ended his political career, but his support for Ukrainian sovereignty, Ukrainian nationalism, and European vocation, I don't think was in question. Yanukovych is a guy who is in political, so figurative as well as literal, debt to Moscow, and even with him, the Kremlin's had a tough time getting him to stand in line. But I think they're also kind of stuck with him. That said, the Russians have made clear in the last couple of days, including during this abortive EU summit, that the carrots that they offered to Ukrainians to get them to turn their back on the EU are not irrevocable. Both the financial assistance in the form of loans and the concessions on gas prices that they offered. So, they continue to have leverage. And I think if Yanukovych were to go, they would obviously watch very carefully what his successor was doing and would make use of the fact that those financial incentives that they offered are contingent, and which they've made clear are contingent.
Well, Jeffrey Manko, given that Putin at the press conference in Brussels made the quip that we'd like to get our money back, referring to the $15 billion loan, and he also went on to say that he didn't mind who was running the place as long as they paid back our money. That's basically what he was saying there. Could they save themselves $15 billion and let the Europeans pick up the tab?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the concern. The first tranche of that loan was only $3 billion, as I understand it. So they have to worry about that. But I think the rest of it, they're kind of waiting and seeing. And that goes for the gas prices concessions as well. Those are going to be reviewed quarterly. So if the Ukrainians do something that they don't like, they can revise those gas prices back up to where they were before. The problem for both Russia, or one of the problems for both Russia and the Europeans, is that Ukraine has an impending budget crisis. They're teetering on the verge of default. And of course, a lot of those debts they owe to Russia for the subsidized gas, or for the gas that they've been receiving and then selling at subsidized prices on the domestic market. And if Russia walks away, yes, there is an enhanced danger of the country tipping into default, but that would also be bad for Russia, not only for its relationship with the West, but also just in terms of its own financial stake in the country.
So how much then is Putin acting out of his sort of geopolitical paranoia about the spread of NATO eastward? Because, basically, I suppose what you could see here in the broader picture is for the Ukrainian people, there are two competing visions of democracy, one that's open, free, and the other one, the one that Putin's offering, which is we may not have the same niceties as they have in Europe, but we have success, and at the same time, of course, it's pretty clear that Putin is turning the clock back in terms of all of the rights, and particularly encouraging the darker side with anti-gay legislation and a very conservative vision of religion. He's stoking all of those fires. So, I'm pretty much editorializing here, saying, I can't understand why anybody would choose the Russian version and not the European version. But give me your sense of how that's playing out inside Ukraine.
Yeah, right. So obviously, the question of NATO expansion hovers over a lot of this, and the real struggles over the post-Soviet space sort of go back to the arguments earlier at the beginning of the 21st century about NATO expansion to Ukraine and also to Georgia. And that's pretty well off the table at this point. NATO said that the door remains open to those countries, but they have a lot of criteria that they need to fulfill before we can start talking about that seriously. And frankly, within NATO, there's very little appetite for pursuing expansion right now. On the question that you raised about democracy and gay rights and things like that, I think there's something kind of instrumental in all of this. It's not to say that Putin doesn't believe in, you know, a particular conception of values that he portrays as being traditional. But I think those are being emphasized now in part with an audience in places like Ukraine in mind. You know, since Putin came back to the Kremlin in 2012, one of his major priorities has been the reconsolidation of the post-Soviet space under Russian suzerainty, at least. He's talked about Eurasia as being a separate entity, not only geopolitical, but also historical and cultural, that it's not part of the West, and that it's not part of Asia, but it's this separate block that exists in between East and West. And as part of that, I think he's trying to play up the historical and cultural differences between Europe, the West, on the one hand, and this Eurasia on the other hand. And so when Putin talks about religion, when he talks about gay rights, doing that, I think, in part to emphasize how Eurasia is not Europe, that there is a fundamental philosophical, moral distinction. And he's counting on, I think, the assumption that most people in Russia, but also in Ukraine and in some of these other post-Soviet countries, accept that or are willing to accept that. One of the arguments that you heard in the run-up to the Vilnius summit when this association agreement between Ukraine and the EU was supposed to be signed, you heard this coming from a lot of Russian commentators, was, you know, why would Ukraine want to sign up for the European Union's standards on gay rights? You know, that's not something that has a lot of support among Ukrainians. And if Ukraine wants to go with the EU, they're going to have to accept things like gay marriage and, you know, all of these other things that are just completely foreign to that culture and that society, which, you know, again, I think this is being done somewhat instrumentally, but that doesn't mean that there's not, that it doesn't find resonance in at least certain constituencies, not only in Russia, but in Ukraine and a lot of the other post-Soviet countries.
But does anybody ask why, you know, these traditional values, if you will, to borrow an American phrase, that Putin is appealing to, why they have to be mutually exclusive with democracy? I mean, what Putin has done in Russia is pretty much kill politics, hasn't he? I mean, it's just a cynical game that's going on there with him and United Russia. And, you know, there was a brief blush or flirtation with democracy there for a while, but he's rolled back every vestige of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they've tried, and for a while it looked like they were pretty successful. You know, in the middle part of the last decade, that ambition seemed to be doing pretty well. You know, they talked about this notion of sovereign democracy, which is basically we decide what democracy means and nobody else has the right to tell us how to do it. There's still a lot of that in the politics and in the discussion in Russia, but I think what you've seen over the last couple of years is that there is politics now. This goes back to really to the 2011 Duma elections, which were rigged quite substantially and which led to, you know, real protests in Moscow and in some of the other cities. And then we saw those protests spread and repeat themselves the next year in the spring when Putin himself was reelected. So there's not united opposition at this point. There's not a cohesive alternative to the status quo. But, you know, if you look at things like Putin's popularity ratings, they're clearly declining, they're stagnating, and people are increasingly looking for alternatives. And I think there's a growing recognition that the system needs more safety valves. So there's been, you know, talk of things like, you know, bringing back municipal elections, for example, which is something that they're, you know, trying to do. And, you know, regardless of what happens in terms of the system, this mobilization from below, I think, is happening and is spreading. It's inchoate at this point, and there's not a unifying figure to bring it all together or a unifying message to unite them. But I think they're forcing the system they're pushing against the system at its weakest points, and they're forcing it to open up around the edges. And so I'd say, whereas, you know, 5 or 6 years ago you could say there's not really politics in Russia, I don't think you can really say that anymore.
Well, Jeffrey Mankoff, I thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a deputy director and fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia program. He's the author of Russia and Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, and Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the jailing of the Al Jazeera reporters in Egypt.
Some cry, but when the sun comes up, when the sun comes up, it will be on my side. It will be on my side.